You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Banks are purchasing mortgage-backed securities from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac at an accelerated pace, the very same toxic assets that they were desperate to dump just a few years ago. The difference this time is that these assets are being guaranteed by the American taxpayer. Gretchen Morgenson, a financial reporter for the New York Times, has been untangling the complex foreclosure mess and the efforts to reform government regulations on Wall Street for several years. She claims in a new book written with Joshua Rosner, an independent researcher, that the financial meltdown was at least 20 years in the making. Reckless endangerment, how outsized ambition, greed, and corruption led to economic Armageddon is published by Times Books, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Gretchen Morgenson and Joshua Rosner to our show today. Welcome.
Thanks, Leonard.
Thank you for having us.
You write that this book is one of many looking into the causes of the financial crisis, but what sets it apart is that you focus not just on financial institutions run wild, but also on the consequences of regulators who are captured by the institutions that they are charged with regulating, and what happens when Washington decides in its infinite wisdom that every living, breathing citizen should own a home. Well, why is owning one's home so much a part of the American dream, and is it still?
It has been a part of the American dream for such a long time. It's really in the psyche, Leonard. It is something that was never questioned throughout this process that really led us to the financial crisis. And it is a noble idea. There is something warm and fuzzy and wonderful and mom and apple pie and American about the idea of having your own home. And plus, it was a forced savings account, as it were, a way to collect wealth, to pass it on to your children. It was in the normal sense of the word, when you had a mortgage that you paid down over the years, a really wonderful instrument for savings. But it became sort of perverted.
When I was growing up, my parents didn't have enough money to ever imagine buying a home, and so we rented. But I have a feeling that in more recent years, they probably would have, because you didn't need as much money
to
put down in the first
place. Exactly right. And we had built a system where at about the time a person got married or household formation began, you'd put 20% down. So it may have been a little later in your life, in your late 20s, early 30s, where it became earlier in this cycle. And you'd make monthly payments of principal and interest. And at about the time you retired, you'd have a mortgage burning party. And you'd have what would be the largest retirement asset, an intergenerational wealth transfer asset.
You'd give it to your kids.
You'd give it or the money to your kids, right. We gutted that notion. And unfortunately, as a result of that, I think we've also really changed the way people view home ownership.
Jody Shen of Bloomberg reported that, I'm quoting, commercial banks' holdings of mortgage bonds guaranteed by Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or Ginny Mae climbed to a record of $1.16 trillion in the week ending May 4th, a rise of $42.7 billion since March 30th. So, Gretchen, are these assets seen as safer investments than some of the other options available to banks? These assets that were toxic just a little while ago?
Well, certainly because, as you know, Leonard, the taxpayer took over Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac Labor Day weekend of 2008. And so this has the good faith and credit of the United States taxpayer behind it. So, yes, very
do treasuries. Safe. Are they considered safer than treasuries or a better investment?
Well, they've got a better rate of return on them for the same risk. And then you also have, I think the Fed has just announced that they're accepting for repo transactions. So there's an opportunity for the banks to take those instead of treasuries to help the Fed drain the system of the excess liquidity ultimately.
So is this the best investment, better than going into the stock market these days?
Well, the stock market is always riskier than anything backed by the full faith and credit of Uncle Sam, Leonard. But it really is very interesting how this has developed, and it is unfortunate. And I think the American taxpayer being the end, you know, sort of the receptacle at the end of what was a true, true mania and a very troubling period of excesses where many people left the scene with loads and loads of money, never to pay it back, to kind of skate away silently and not to be either prosecuted or even held accountable.
And many not skate away. right? Many of the same people who brought the crisis to a theater near
They're
you
are still there.
Are not only still there, in many cases have been elevated to higher positions within their organizations or within the government.
Is there an irony that the banks sold off most of their exposure to mortgages and they were purchased by Fannie and Freddie and now they're buying them back?
Well,
I realize it's under other circumstances. They sold them off when they were risky and now they're buying them back when they're not risky. But
it's a very good trade, don't you think?
Yes, I wish I could do that in other things. Aren't there Republicans who'd like to see limits placed on how much of the taxpayers' dollars can be made available to Fannie and Freddie?
Well, we're in the midst, and Josh can speak to this as well, we're in the midst of the discussions about what to do about Fannie and Freddie because we are now at about $154 billion that the taxpayers are in to these companies, and obviously that can't continue. We are the politicians are trying to decide what to do, how to resolve these companies, do we have them in the future? But Josh, are we having a really honest discussion in Washington?
Yeah, I've been covering this as an analyst for the past almost 20 years, and no, we're still not having an honest dialogue. And by the way, as much as Washington wants to create this public dynamic of it being Republicans or Dems, there was equal culpability in terms of the ability to capture Congress and in turn regulators by the financial service industry successfully caught both the Republicans and the Dems. And so the dialogue today is actually less about what really is even the right answer for housing finance than it is for the institutions.
Well, there are the political parties' positions, and then there's also the matter of whether you represent a state where there's a lot of banking being done or there are, you know, large insurance companies. So it doesn't matter which party you're in under those circumstances.
Yeah. So the only variant is the small banks versus the New York-based banks. And the community bankers are usually at odds with the New York-based banks. So
now,
that's one of the tensions.
What if the government decides to step back from supporting these mortgage obligations?
That would probably be something that would be, after having gone through what we just went through, positive thing to discuss.
On the new obligations.
Yeah, on new obligations.
But nobody would argue these are too big to fail?
No. Oh, well, that is a very, very crucial question that must be addressed that Washington has proved absolutely unable to address. And in fact, Leonard, if you go back in the 90s when Fannie and Freddie were growing, ballooning their balance sheet, really starting to imperil the taxpayers, albeit, under wraps, they were the only sort of too-big-to-fail institutions out there. Now we have many because of all of the banks that were bailed out in the last couple of years. The sense is they will be bailed out again if they get into trouble.
And that's one of the underlying points that we really try to make in the book is that it was Fannie and Freddie under Jim Johnson's leadership that really taught the rest of the financial service industry that you don't need to capture your regulator if you capture Congress.
Well, James Johnson, who's Fannie Mae's CEO, is one of the people who we probably haven't heard much about because you do have a number of people whose names became household names, Angelo Mozzillo, Jamie Dimon, Lloyd Blankfein, Stan O'Neill, Timothy Geithner. Why has he escaped that kind of, should we say, fame or infamy?
You pick it. He left Fannie Mae as CEO in 1998, was vice chairman in 99. He was still on the scene there. But he was very adept at sort of knowing when to exit, I think. He had also made immense riches at the top of Fannie Mae over that period of time and so was ready to move on. And he took on very large, high-profile jobs in Washington, running the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, running the Brookings Institution. So it wasn't like he just went to the golf course. He was still in a very big position of power and maintained that in Washington.
With the Kerry campaign. And
he had been early with Mondale.
Early with Mondale. He was originally President Obama's head of his VP search committee.
Had Fannie and Freddie been caught up in any of the earlier financial meltdowns, like the SNL crisis in the 1980s?
Yeah, well, Fannie and Freddie were both caught up in the early crises. Fannie was insolvent on a mark-to-market basis during that same period.
In the early 80s.
That was really when, as a result of that insolvency, Washington decided that it was going to create a new regulator to regulate Fannie and Freddie, which they sought to do. And in that process, they really let the management of Fannie and Freddie design its own regulatory structure,
which was really to its own benefit. My guests are Gretchen Morgenson and Joshua Rosner. Their book, Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. It's published by Times Books. Well, what was the original mandate for Fannie Mae when it was created in 1938? It wasn't a lender. It wasn't a bank.
It was really designed to, come and step in during times of stress in the mortgage industry. Of course, at that point in time, we were still in the Great Depression, and you needed to have a way for homeowners to be able to borrow money that banks were not lending, just as we're sort of going through that again now. It was really designed to be a facilitator for the financing of homes by borrowers.
So, and did it mostly function that way? Because yeah. You say that later, Johnson built Fannie Mae into what you call the largest, most powerful financial institution in the world.
Yeah. So back in the Depression, most people had five-year mortgages. And so if you couldn't find a bank that was going to roll your mortgage at the end of the 5 years, you would need to come up the money to pay down your mortgage entirely. Well, that was an almost impossible task for people. So Fannie and Freddie – well, Fannie in the late 30s, Freddie in the late 60s were chartered for the purpose of providing liquidity in this sort of counter-cyclical, making sure there was adequate liquidity in the mortgage market, and created the 30-year mortgage, which we've all come to view as the standard product.
So if I went to a bank to get a mortgage, what was Fannie Mae's actual role in that transaction?
Would not be involved. The bank would lend you the money. Then they would go and they would sell the loan to Fannie Mae or else have Fannie Mae guarantee it.
If it was in their lending buying criteria.
But it was created by the government, and yet it was a quasi-private company that meant it had shareholders, and it generated
earnings
and pays out dividends.
Doesn't pay out a dividend anymore, but it's still a quasi-public company.
And paid out very, very immense riches to its top executives.
But when people bought Fannie or Freddie's debt, wasn't there an underlying assumption that it was all government-backed and that meant it was safe?
Yeah. Actually, it was very funny. So I remember having a meeting with someone from one of the foreign ministries of finance back in 2003, very senior official, and we were talking about the problems that I saw at Fannie and Freddie from an accounting perspective. And he said, but you know what? We own a lot of their debt, but their debt's fully guaranteed by the government. And I said, no, it's not. He said, what do you mean, no, it's not? I said, it's not implicitly or explicitly guaranteed by the government. Oh, really?
This is a sophisticated banker.
This is a sophisticated person within the Ministry of Finance at a full first world economy.
But guess
government.
What? He was right.
He was
ultimately,
right.
Ultimately, in 2008,
exactly right.
The taxpayers do have to pick up the tab.
That's right.
But how is it possible that Fannie was exempt from filing regulatory financial statements with the SEC? And it has a line of credit with the Treasury, doesn't it, despite the fact
yes.
that it doesn't have to make any public filings?
Well, it does now. These were all perquisites that were associated with its creation as a government entity, an agency sort of the government.
Well, why would you give it so much leeway?
Well, it was all, again, a part of this homeownership idea that these were good – these were utilities, essentially, Leonard, that were set in place to help Americans. And so we're not going to require them to do, the same sorts of things that a commercial, fully private institution like a bank has to do.
And that really is one of – I think one of the important – items to take away from not only the crisis but also the book. When we hear the word public-private partnership or public-private initiative, I think we should be leery, because sometimes what's intended to be a public utility for the good of the citizens in the hands of a profit-seeking entity definitionally put it in conflict with its mission. And that's really what we saw the entire housing complex take on.
We have lots of questions from our listeners, but because we're going to go to a break, I'm going to ask one of the briefer ones. How does debt ceiling factor into this discussion, or does it?
Well, I mean, the debt ceiling does in some sense, because we're going to have to decide whether we're going to take Fannie and Freddie's obligations onto the government balance sheet if we fully nationalize their functions. I don't think that's going to happen. So I think in reality, it's not playing into it.
My guests are Gretchen Morgenson, who is business reporter and columnist for The New York Times, where she also serves as assistant business and financial editor. She was awarded a Pulitzer Prize in 2002 for her, quote, trenchant and incisive coverage of Wall Street. And Joshua Rosner is a managing director of the independent research consultancy Graham Fisher & Company. He was among the first analysts to identify accounting problems at the government-sponsored enterprises and to warn of the coming credit crisis. And he advises regulators and institutional investors on housing and mortgage finance-related issues. We'll talk about regulators when we come back. Their book, Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. And it had nothing to do with May 21st, but that's a different Armageddon, although this one's
that
going
one
on
passed.
A lot longer. It's published by Times Books. Stay with us. We're back with Gretchen Morgenson, a business reporter and columnist at The New York Times, where she also serves as assistant business and financial editor, and Joshua Rosner, a managing director at the independent research consultancy Graham Fisher & Company. They have co-authored a book called Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. It's published by Times Books, and our listeners have been writing in all sorts of interesting questions.
Great.
I'll get to them as we go along, because a number of them have to do with regulation. So let's talk about that for a moment. You have a list of key players in the book. It's interesting that you label one section as feckless regulators. Was anyone who was in charge of regulation actually doing their job?
You know, I think, Leonard, there were people who were in the maybe lower ranks or mid ranks of some of the organizations, whether it's the Federal Reserve Board or some of the banking regulation operations, were doing their job and were trying to be heard. But it was a really big political and powerful machine that was pumping here. I mean, we are talking about industry, government, pooling their resources together to promote home ownership. It was something that was very difficult to go against, honestly.
As a matter of fact, even Fannie and Freddie's own regulator in 2003, Armando Falcone, wrote a letter to the heads of the House Financial Services and Senate Banking Committee warning of the risk of a systemic problem. His resignation was asked for 24 hours later. So there were people who were trying. The political class weighed on the regulatory class.
But it goes deeper. Fannie Mae, according to your reporting, fudged accounting rules, generated big salaries and bonuses for its executives, used lobby and campaign contributions to bully regulators, and encouraged the risky financial practices that led to the crisis. And they got away with it all?
Well, they didn't get away with it because, of course, now they've been taken over and they're a shadow of their former selves. But a lot of the people who were there at the time did get away with it,
and they walked away with a lot of money.
Absolutely.
Incredible amounts of money.
So here we have a circumstance that, you know, really this was a company that almost instructed or taught others, say, in the financial services arena, how to do this very task of neutralizing your regulator, co-opting Congress. You know, it really was a playbook almost for the very sorts of activities and behavior that we are seeing in Washington today.
It's also not just Fannie Mae. There's this – it's a network. It's a web, and it continues to sort of change. There's huge amounts of relationship between Fannie Mae and Goldman Sachs, between Goldman Sachs and Citi, between Citi and J.P. Morgan, all of them back to the federal government employment.
I'm glad you mentioned that because a number of people have written in saying that it seems that the two of you are trying to divert the blame from the big banks onto Fannie and Freddie.
No.
That would be wrong.
and frankly, if you read the book, you'll see really it was almost this housing industrial complex, right? We talk about the military industrial complex. This really is the housing industrial complex, and it was dominated not by just Fannie and Freddie, but by Fannie and Freddie and Goldman and J.P. Morgan and Citi and the National Association of Realtors and the home builders. And it really was this web where they all had incredible amounts of political influence and relationship.
Were they in collusion, or was it just that everybody saw this as an opportunity to make money?
Socially and functionally, they were in collusion. I don't think that we could say legally there was necessarily collusion, but I think functionally and in fact, from just sort of the effect, it was collusive.
I think if you argued against home ownership, Leonard, you were sort of laughed at. I mean, what are
you? Un-American.
You're against American mom and apple pie. It was very difficult to stand up to this. But as far as the answer to the question about the bank's involvement here, it is crucial. It is very deep and it is very troubling. And you will find a great deal of it in the book, particularly at the very end of the crisis, Leonard, when the banks knew that these loans that they were buying from originators like Countrywide, like New Century, they knew they were bad. They knew they were toxic. And yet they continued to buy them, put them into securities, and sell them to investors, even knowing that they were really poisonous.
But didn't they know eventually that
they'd get bailed out?
They thought they'd be bailed out. They didn't think that eventually they'd have to pay a price for this.
Part of the reason that I think they felt so confident is, as example, Tim Geithner, who was the head of the New York Fed before he became Treasury Secretary, had been appointed to the New York Fed because that job is filled by the banks in the New York region. He'd been put there by the same folks who ultimately he'd end up having to decide to support as in the crisis as the head of the New York Fed. And the relationship between the banks and the New York Fed was extraordinary, and between the Treasury. So Tim Geithner's mentor was Bob Rubin, who was the former chairman of Goldman Sachs. He was Secretary of Treasury. And Bob Rubin, as Treasury Secretary, supported the repeal of Glass-Steagall, and right after that happened, went to become vice chairman of Citibank. So the revolving door is really the issue here. And Fannie and Freddie have this incredible revolving door relationship, but no more, no less than the banks.
If we reinstated Glass-Steagall, would everything be resolved?
It's very difficult to go back to a law that was that served a very, very good purpose for, 66 years or something like that, because things have changed so dramatically. I think a better way to think about it is to go down a path where you start to break up these large institutions, where you start to say they're too big to operate. Not only are they too big to be allowed to fail, they're too big to operate and they're too threatening to the taxpayer.
Andrew Ross Sorkin, who is also a columnist at The Times, was on our show to talk about his book, Too Big to Fail, which has recently been made into an HBO film. He argues that banks such as Wells, Bank of America, and Citibank are even bigger than they were before the crisis. So what protections have been put in place to prevent another crisis from happening?
Absolutely none. In fact, you know, we have this charade called the Dodd-Frank Act, which is 2,300-plus pages. For the purpose of trying to ensure and make us feel like we're safe. But at the end of the day, if we have a risk to one of our too-big-to-fail institutions, we'll have a risk to several of them at the same time. And these same people who were up at Congress crying for $700 billion will again be up in Congress crying for more than $700 billion.
You're calling that act a fraud? He's been a defender of Barney Frank of Fannie Mae for a long time. He was the co-author of that legislation in 2010, mm-hmm. which was, you're saying, supposed to reform Wall Street, but didn't really do it. Is it true that he asked Fannie Mae to hire his companion as he was weighing a new regulatory structure for the company?
Well, he was a member of the Financial Services Committee in the House at the time. That it was a very crucial time, Leonard, for Fannie Mae, because it was the moment when Congress was deciding how to make sure that taxpayers would not be threatened with losses at the company. And so there was going to be a new regulator in place. There were going to be new capital requirements, and what those are is a cushion of money to set aside for a rainy day when losses come about. And so what happened was, at the time that Congress was mulling this over, trying to write this legislation that was going to protect us, the taxpayer, Barney was actually asked Fannie Mae to hire his companion, who had just graduated from Amos Tuck School of Business. And of course the company was happy to oblige. This was a wonderful opportunity for them. They hired him immediately. He worked there for quite a few years, I believe around 7 years. Now, when we asked Barney about whether or not this put him in a conflicted position, he said no, he didn't have any recollection of having anything to do with the 1992 Act.
Didn't Fannie Mae also make several contributions to a charity his mother co-founded in Boston?
That's true.
Yeah, and by the way, this isn't just Barney Frank, and it's not just one side of the aisle or the other. We had Senator Bob Benitz, whose son was hired to run one of the offices for the Fannie Mae Foundation. Nancy Pelosi's son was at Countrywide. She was he was on the short list, I think, of people during Countrywide staff reductions when there was apparently someone stepped into. Angelo Mozzillo is our understanding, stepped in to help save his job. So this has unfortunately just become so ingrained in the fabric of the way Washington and the financial service industry work and scratch each other's backs that, yes.
And then there are former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin and his then Deputy Larry Summers, who protected Fannie Mae from being subjected to tougher oversight and regulation in the mid-1990s.
That was another important moment when you had, Congress had asked that four agencies of the government analyze the potential for privatizing Fannie Mae, which would mean taking it out of the taxpayers' burden if there were ever a loss. And the Treasury was preparing a report that was going to provide a roadmap, really, for where you could go in this privatization process. And the civil servants who were preparing that report were told by Larry Summers to tone it down and to let's put off that whole discussion about privatization.
So that was a lost opportunity to rein them in.
Absolutely.
A listener asks, since these mortgage-backed securities are being purchased again by the banks at values that might be inflated, is there another bubble being created?
Well, I think there are bubbles everywhere. I would be more worried about bubbles in the commodities market. What do you think, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, they're being bought by – it depends on which securities you're talking about. But the securities, the MBS, the mortgage-backed securities that are being purchased and the agency securities, I think are not really endemic of example of a bubble as much as it's an opportunity for people, they think, to get better recoveries. They think there was overselling.
Another question, when the crisis hit and one had to actually assess what the value of the mortgage-backed securities were, banks had to write down the value because the question is how much are mortgage-backed securities actually worth? Not much at the time, but now that they're government-backed, the value seems false.
Well, hold on. The notion, we have to, not to get too complicated about this, but we have to separate price and value. So the mortgage-backed securities pay cash flows because what they are is a pool of your mortgage and Gretchen's mortgage and my mortgage, all of our mortgages, and we make payments every month, hopefully. And so the value of them is tied to how much payment goes through relative to the expectation. In the height of the crisis, you had investors piling out of these securities because they were afraid that large numbers of people would stop making payments. Well, in fact, that did happen, but there was such a sale that the price of the securities still went down further than in many cases the value of the securities. And so in some cases they were overvalued still. And in other cases, there was an opportunity for the banks to write them down so far that they at some point would write them back up.
Many people are concerned now that the bubble will be in the commodity market. Oil, gold, silver?
Yeah.
You see the dangers there?
Well,
you certainly do see tremendous price movements. And, you know, the moment, Leonard, that it begins to affect Main Street is when you really have to worry, i.e. paying at the pump, you know, the cost of food. These are genuine, genuine pain being felt by average people. And so the degree to which Wall Street and big pools of capital are pushing these kinds of prices is a deep concern, I think, to a lot of people.
Yeah, and you also have to remember this is a part of a larger dialogue. Our Federal Reserve, our central bank, and Ben Bernanke himself has long taken the view that it shouldn't be up to the Fed to determine what the appropriate price of an asset is. And so where other central banks believe that they should, when they see a bubble, prick the bubble before it gets too large, our central bank has historically taken the view of, we'll let it keep going and it's not for us to prick the bubble. And we seem to continue not to have learned from our past.
We have large holdings in gold, don't we, at Fort Knox still? I wonder whether we could sell some of that off right now.
The New York Fed has the New York Fed, I think, is the largest concentration. Unfortunately, a lot of what's there is held there for foreign governments. Mm-hmm. So we stockpile everyone's gold.
A listener who signs his name Guy from Nolitas says, please ask about the total cost of the bank bailout. Most commentators often refer to the first TARP, $700 billion. But thanks to Bloomberg News Service and Senator Bernie Sanders, we know that the actual total was $12.3 trillion, and that was 1 year ago. It's probably more now. That's $3.3 trillion in cash and $9 trillion in tax credits, subsidies, and low interest loans with no strings attached. This is the greatest transfer of wealth in recorded human history. The amount leaves one numb.
Here's what I have to say when anyone says to me, did we pay back the TARP? Did people pay back the TARP? Is the government going to make money on these bailouts? You hear a lot from the Treasury that the government is going to make money, for instance, on the AIG bailout. My view on this is we are so far away from being able to assess whether we will make money on this, what the losses will be, that it is really imprudent for the Treasury to even pretend that we're going to make money on this. Not to mention that we're into Fannie and Freddie for $154 billion right there. So I think that what your listeners need to think of when they hear someone from the government saying, look, we're making money on these bailouts, is we have to vet that. We have to truth squad that.
Well, and you also have to remember that part of the reason that we may make money on one of the specific transactions, AIG as example, is also tied to the broader policies, the broader sloshing into the system of money and asset purchases. So the Fed goes out and buys $1.25 trillion of mortgage-backed securities. It boosts the prices of all of those, the entire asset class, which also helps a lot of the transfers, the AIG deals, et cetera, look more profitable than they ultimately may be when you look at it as a closed system.
We've been told that we're going through a hopeful recovery. But you shake your head no. Unemployment remains at 9%. So can we have a jobless recovery?
Unfortunately, I think that we can have a jobless recovery for a number of reasons. We've got several of the things that were tailwinds supporting consumption for the past 40 years are now headwinds. The largest generation in American history is moving from consumption toward retirement. We'll be spending less in many of the areas that have been consumption-driven. We've got the democratization of credit that supported consumption for the past 40 years going the other way. We've got interest rates ultimately will be going the other way. We've got the family that went from one-income families to two-income families is by necessity going back. We've got a lot of structural issues that we need to contend with.
Josh, should I be moving to Costa Rica?
Is that an option?
That sounds like a nice place, actually. It's sunny there.
What about the credit rating agencies? Have any meaningful changes taken place there?
Unfortunately not. We've had a lot of discussion about the really deplorable failures of the credit rating agencies to see the crises coming, to even be able to accurately assess these securities. There really has been very little change on that score. And I'll tell you, whenever I speak to people or in my email box, that is one of the main questions I get.
Well, it's even funnier than – I mean, not funny, ha-ha, funny, sad, actually, that – Dodd-Frank intended to take the rating agencies out of the mix. All federal reference to them would be pulled out. But more than that, the exemption from Reg FD, which is the rating agencies had access to corporate information that other investors didn't, and that was theoretically what they should have but didn't really use in their analysis, that was pulled away. So now you've got the same bad rating agencies with now less information than they had in the crisis, leading to the crisis, and investors have no more information.
Do you think that was done intentionally? I mean, sometimes legislation doesn't work well because people didn't realize the implications.
There were enough people who were explaining that the problem was not the narrative that Wall Street gave. The narrative that Wall Street gave was, well, of course the rating agencies were problematic. They were paid by the issuers. Well, if they were paid by the investors, there'd be a conflict as well, right? So you need to address the conflict. Nothing was done to address that conflict.
Joshua Rosner is a managing director at the independent research consultancy Graham Fisher and Company, and co-author with Gretchen Morgenson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning business reporter and columnist at the New York Times, where she also serves as assistant business and financial editor of a new book called Reckless Endangerment: How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. It's published by Times Books. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you for having us.